You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 11th. I'm Anna from Drake University, and here's our first story. Our first story is Jorgensen charged with OWI. Democrats call on county supervisors to step down. Okay, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right. It's Pottawatomie County. Pottawatomie. County Supervisor Jeff Jorgensen is facing calls to resign after he was charged with operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated at over twice the legal limit last weekend. On Saturday, the 69-year-old was driving westbound on Interstate 80 in Council Bluffs at approximately 5:35 p.m. When he hit a car that was parked in the shoulder, he got out of his pickup truck and fell onto the roadway, according to an affidavit. An Iowa State Patrol trooper who responded to the scene reported Jorgensen smelled strongly of alcohol and couldn't stand without losing his balance, the affidavit. Jorgensen's truck also had front-end damage. After he allegedly admitting to having too many drinks and field sobriety tests were conducted, Jorgensen was arrested, according to authorities. His blood alcohol content was measured at 0.168. The limit in Iowa is 0.08. Jorgensen has been charged with first offense of operating a vehicle while under the influence of alcohol, which is a serious misdemeanor. Jorgensen, a Republican, has served on the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors since January 2023, and his term is set to end in December 2026. Lisa Lima, chair of the Pottawatomie County Democrats, released a statement Monday calling for Jorgensen to resign immediately. Quote, "Our community deserves elected leadership that takes responsibility seriously and acts with integrity," end quote. Lima said in the statement, quote, "Mr. Jorgensen undermines the trust and confidence of Pottawatomie County citizens with his continued poor choices," end quote. Jorgensen could not be immediately reached for comment Tuesday by the Hama World Herald. Moving on to the next story, we have Wyatt picked to fill vacant judicial role. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds named a Glenwood jurist as a district court judge. Justin Wyatt will become a judge in the 4th Judicial District, Reynolds announced Friday in a news release. The 48-year-old and his associate judge in the 4th District, a position he's held since March 2022. He's earned his undergraduate and law degrees from Creighton University in Omaha. He is filling a vacancy created by the retirement of Judge Kathleen Kilnowski. Wyatt wrote in his application for the appointment that he feels a call to service. Quote, "In my personal life, I have always served others through various volunteering organizations," end quote. Wyatt wrote, quote, "As a general practitioner, I was naturally drawn to court-appointed casework because it gave me the opportunity to help those who desperately needed help. My appointment to the bench as a district associate judge has been an absolute gift. I enjoy every moment of it because it has given me the opportunity to serve a broader swath of citizens," end quote. The Judicial Nominating Commission for the 4th District recommended Wyatt and Donna Bothwell for the appointment. Bothwell is also an associate judge in the 4th District and lives in Logan. Other applicants seeking the appointment were the Army Garians, an attorney and owner at Garians Law from Council Bluffs, Paul Forney, an attorney and owner at Forney Law Firm from Council Bluffs, who had been working in the Pottawatomie County Attorney's Office, Rich Arnold, an assistant attorney general from Council Bluffs, and Vanessa Stratus, the council attorney for Cass County at Atlantic. Wyatt's previous work experiences include a partner for more than a decade at Woods, Wyatt and Tucker, PLLC in Glenwood. He has worked as a law clerk while he was in law school, and then as an associate attorney at Peters Law Firm in Glenwood, where he started as a runner recipient and then information technology associate. As an attorney, Wyatt practiced in a variety of fields of law, including adoptions, guardianships, and conservatorships in the district court, as well as criminal defense and prosecuting municipal infractions. He primarily practiced juvenile and criminal law. Most of his work as an associate judge has been in juvenile court cases, handling cases in, again, I don't know how to pronounce this, A-U-D-U-B-O-N, Audubon, Cass, Harrison, and Montgomery counties. He said in his application that he's the only associate judge who handles cases in all 9 counties in the 4th District, which spans Audubon, Cass, Fremont, Harrison, Mills, Montgomery, Page, Pottawatomie, and Shelby counties. Quote, I have been assigned criminal matters in all 9 counties of the 4th Judicial District. End quote. Wyatt wrote this in his application. Quote, I am the only judge in the district who is regularly assigned motion days in all 8 out counties every month. I am regularly assigned criminal bench trials and jury trials throughout the district. In Pottawatomie County, I have handled initial appearances, arraignments, contempt, revocations, and sentencings, and needed. Quote, why preside over the success through empowering parenting sobriety family treatment court in Audubon and Cass counties, the only such court of its kind in the 4th District? He is working with a steering committee to create a nonprofit to allow family treatment programs throughout the district to be self-funded. Quote, Steps Family Treatment Court has given me the opportunity to connect with parents on a personal level so we can find ways to get their children home. End quote. Quote, Steps Family Treatment Court has kept me emotionally grounded and connected to the people who appear before me, whether it is in a juvenile or a criminal setting, he said. I am acutely aware that every decision I make has real-world consequences for these people and their families. As an attorney, people rarely came to see me because they were having a good day. It has been no different as a judge. End quote. Moving on to our next story, IPTV Trivia Night planned in Harlan. Iowa PBS's new series, Road Trip Iowa, takes viewers on an adventure across Iowa's scenic byways, showcasing the historic sites, unique attractions, and natural beauty along the way. This new weekly travel show is running Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. with rebroadcasts Saturdays at 9 a.m. and on-demand streaming at iowapbs.org and the PBS app, according to a news release. Each 30-minute episode features businesses, towns, and landscapes along the byways of Iowa. Viewers will venture to the mines of Spain and Dubuque, the Banner Lakes at Somerset State Park, and the Salt and Pepper Shaker Gallery in Traer and other destinations around the state. Quote, Road Trip Iowa is designed for Iowans who enjoy taking the scenic route. We're inviting viewers to get off the interstate and discover the rewards found along the longer path. End quote, Tyler Bridgenar, an Iowa PBS senior producer and director, said in the release. Quote, it contains a mix of these small towns that made Iowa what it is today, as well as the natural wonders that were here long before us. End quote. Iowa PBS will host 3 trivia nights to celebrate the launch of the series, including an event Friday, May 10th in Harlan. Advanced registration is required. The top 3 teams at each event will be awarded prizes and attend to inspire their own Iowa road trip. And our next story is New Glenwood Redemption Center draws interest. There's a place in Glenwood that's becoming quite a destination spot for those with empty cans and bottles. The community has a new drop-it redemption center at 306 South Vine Street near Glenwood City Field. Quote, it's been well received, end quote, said Jenny Davis, executive director of the Mills County Chamber of Commerce. It's open 24/7 and the location is convenient. You can just drive by whenever you like and do your own redeeming. The new center got its start last fall when the Glenwood Resource Center announced it would close its redemption center in January. Not only is the new location popular with the public, but local stores are able to collect cans and bottles and take them to the drop-it center as well, Davis said. Quote, I had people asking me if there was a plan when the redemption center closed, Davis said, end quote. She contacted a city official about a possible solution and was told that a Des Moines bottle and can redemption company, Drop It, had contacted the city about its services. Davis and city officials worked together on the details, which included a structure and electrical connections. It was a big collaboration, she said. The design was outside of the structure, was created by a local artist. Quote, we got Drop It up and running in March, end quote, Davis said. There's a picture of a man on a trunk, and he's loading bags full of bottles. And then there's a picture below with the decoration outside one of the buildings. To use this service is starting with an account quite simple, she said, on dropit.com. It takes just minutes, she said. In a couple of days, you will receive a welcome packet and 10 bag tags that you put on your trash bags. From there, you collect recyclables that consist of cans and bottles, end quote. Once they're ready to recycle, the residents will take them to the site and scan their bag tags to the outdoor scanner. The door will then unlock, and the residents will simply throw their bags inside. Drop It employees will then sort everything back at the headquarters, and user person's account will be created on the amount of recyclables, Davis said. Residents will be credited only on those bottles and cans with the 5-cent refund policy under Iowa's deposit law, Davis said. Drop It will still recycle bottles and cans that aren't part of the 5-cent policy, though the residents won't be credited for those, she added. Once residents have $15 or more in their Drop It accounts, they can transfer that to their regular checkings or savings accounts or keep it growing in the Drop It account if they so desire, Davis said. This service has not cost the city anything other than a monthly $35 electrical bill, she said, which is, quote, the only fee associated with it, end quote. Drop It also allows nonprofit to set up accounts. Quote, it can be a good fundraiser for the nonprofits, end quote. On Tuesday, Drop It employee Chris Turner came to town to pick up a load. Quote, it's getting a lot more business, end quote, he said. People love it. Turner estimated he was going to collect more than 180 items. He said the first time he made a collection, he only found a few items. Quote, the week after that it was full, end quote, he said. He and another employee now come twice a week to collect items. It's a real convenience, especially in rural towns, Turner said. Should the redemption center continue to draw users, it should open the door to more. Hopefully, this is a step in the right direction to bring recycling back to Glenwood, Davis said. And our next story, lawmaker, bottle bill law may need repeal. Changes have resulted in fewer redemption centers. This one is also about a redemption center for recycling. Two-year-old changes in Iowa's recycling law have resulted in fewer places for Iowans to return their recyclable bottles and cans to redeem the 5-cent per container deposit, a group of Iowa recyclers said on Monday. A key state lawmaker said if the state recycling program struggles, the next legislative move may be to repeal the law. Under Iowa's recycling program, consumers pay a 5-cent deposit on most plastic and aluminum beer and soda containers. They can recoup that nickel by returning empty containers to redemption centers on retailers. The program was created to encourage Iowans to recycle their plastic and aluminum bottles and cans. States with a deposit law have a beverage recycling rate about 60%, while states without deposits have a recycling rate of about 24%, according to the Container Recycling Institute. In 2022, the state repealed the requirement that grocery and convenience stores accept returnable recyclables. That new law also increased the fee pay by beverage distributors to redemption centers, with the goal of incentivizing the expansion and the creation of more redemption centers across the state. 2 years later, the number of state-licensed redemption centers has increased. There are 104 active state-licensed centers, according to the state, but not enough to offset the number of grocery and convenience stores that got out of the recycling business, according to the members of the nonprofit advocacy group Cleaner Iowa, which includes recycling companies. The fee increase has led to more redemption centers opening across the state, but more are needed. Mick Berry, a former president of Mid-America Recycling in Des Moines, said Monday at a news conference hosted by Cleaner Iowa at the Iowa Capitol. Quote, the unintended consequence of this bill, however, has been actually a net reduction in places to redeem your containers for consumers and citizens of the state, and thus creating a lack of convenient redemption as envisioned by Governor Robert Ray and Governor Terry Branstad when they created this law back in 1979, end quote, Berry said. Cleaner Iowa surveyed more than 1,000 Iowa businesses, mainly grocery stores and convenience stores, and found that only 8.7% of those businesses are redeeming recyclable containers. Furthermore, only 8 of 143 businesses contacted that still required to participate in the state recycling law are doing so, according to the group. Leaders of the group said that they believe that this is because Iowans are not aware that they must file a complaint with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources before the state will investigate. The mass exodus of grocery and convenience stores from the program has created what the group is calling recycling deserts, where individuals must travel to the nearest redemption center. There are 29 counties without a redemption center, according to the state figures analyzed by Cleaner Iowa. Representative Brian Lowe's R. Bondurant, a key legislator, is writing the 2022 changes into law, said if the state recycling program struggles under the recent enacted changes, the next step may be to repeal the 5-cent deposit. Quote, if this doesn't work, I think the next step is to get rid of it. It's clearly not working across the state, end quote, Lowe said. If it's not going to work, what is the next step? I think one of the most important options on the table is just to repeal it. We try to fix it, and if it's not going to work, then we may have to try something, and we have to take a really hard look at it, end quote. R.G. Schwarm, executive director of Cleaner Iowa and an Iowa Capitol lobbyist, noted the state recycling program popularity. A 2022 poll conducted by Selzer and Co. for Cleaner Iowa showed that 84% of Iowans said the recycling law is good for the state, and said Cleaner Iowa's survey was conducted with the hopes of providing an early snapshot of the impact of the 2022 changes to the law. As part of those changes, a legislative committee will review the program in 2025. Quote, the bottle bill works, but it's clear that there are some areas that need attention, including enforcement issues, Schwarm said. We hope lawmakers will approach the 2025 fiscal review committee with an open mind, with the objectives to make bottle bill systems that Iowans care about better and more convenient, end quote. And then there's a picture of a young lady. She has a lot of bags full of empty cans that are recyclables, and it's at a redemption center. The next story is state representatives okay traffic camera regulations. After years of working to regulate traffic enforcement cameras with competing opinions on how far to go, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill on Tuesday that would require state approval for traffic cameras and restrict them to certain areas. Republican state lawmakers have long sought to rein the use of speed cameras and the red light cameras that have proliferated across the state. Lawmakers have argued that they are often abused by local governments to drive up revenue from tickets. But police officials have resisted the measures, saying that they are a vital part of city's public safety strategy. House File 2681 passed on 85-12 on Tuesday. The Senate has a similar bill eligible for a floor vote. The bill would require local governments to receive a permit from the Department of Transportation before installing a traffic camera system and require that they be installed only in high-risk areas. The city or county would need to report the severity of traffic collisions at the location that they want to install a camera, and show that the camera is at least a restrictive method of improving public safety. There are around 25 cities in the state with traffic cameras currently in place, according to an analysis by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Some Republican lawmakers want to amend the bill to ban the use of speed cameras entirely, but the measure is failed in a 47-54 vote. Representative John Wills, R. Spirit Lake, introduced the amendment and said that the believed cameras are an infringement of constitutional rights. He said also the constituents who received tickets when someone else was driving their car, which said was unfair. Quote, these cameras are not fair. They're not something that we should be doing out justice in a way that is not fair to our citizens in this state, he said. These traffic cameras are speed traps. I don't believe they're constitutional. Representative Brian Best, R. Gildon, who managed the House bill and opposed the full ban, said that the bill was a compromise that was will restrict necessary traffic cameras while allowing their use where it is needed. Quote, "We have to do something," end quote, he said. "And with this, the amendment and this bill, we will be doing nothing. And I think there's a lot going to be unwanted, unneeded traffic cameras that are going to keep springing up." Representative Sammy Sheets, District Cedar Rapids, said that the cameras on the S-curve on Interstate 380 in the city have dramatically reduced police stops and injuries from collisions. According to a 2022 report from the city of Cedar Rapids, the likelihood of a crash on the S-curve causing injury was cut by nearly half when a traffic camera was in use, and the number of collisions was reduced by 15.5%. This technology not only saves lives by reducing high-speed accidents, but it also protects our first responders by minimizing risky traffic stops, Sheets said. What does the bill do? Under the bill, cities would need to gain approval from the DOT before installing traffic cameras. Cities with existing systems would need to approve or apply for approval, and they could continue using the cameras until their request is processed. Only cities and counties with a population of more than 20,000 would be allowed to issue a fine using a traffic camera, which encompasses around 25 of Iowa's largest cities. Smaller cities would still be allowed to install traffic cameras if approved, but they could use only an issue-warranted warning. The cities would not be able to issue a ticket unless a driver was driving more than 10 miles over the speed limit, and the maximum amount would range from $75 to $500 based on the speed, or up to $1,000 in a work zone. Any revenue collected by the systems would be restricted for on-transportation and infrastructure or police and fire departments. Our next story is Senate passes bill to aid Boy Scout abuse victims. The Iowa Senate unanimously passed a bill Tuesday that would temporarily lift the state's statute of limitations for filing civil claims on sexual abuse to allow Iowa victims to receive full compensation from a national settlement with the Boy Scouts of America. Senate File 2431 now heads to the Iowa House for consideration. Lawmakers face a ticking clock. Iowa has 1 year from the effective date of the settlement trust by Friday, April 19th, to change the law, or else Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country, according to an attorney involved in the matter. That means lawmakers must pass, and Governor Kim Reynolds must sign the bill into law before then for survivors to receive the larger amount. Although this is not going to be able to take away the true pain that happened years ago, hopefully this will give a little bit of relief for their lives going forward, end quote, said Senator Tim Krayenbrick for Fort Dodge, the bill's fort manager. What does the bill do? The bill temporarily would lift the state's statute of limitations so that the victims of sexual abuse while in the Boy Scouts can receive damage from the Scouting Settlement Trust, a $2.5 billion trust fund established last year after the Scouts filed for bankruptcy protection. The Scouts filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement approved in court 2022 that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million for claims against the Boy Scouts of America, as well as all claims against local Boy Scouts councils and supporting organizations. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who say they were abused by children. They were abused as children by troop leaders. That fund, the largest of its kind in U.S. history to settle sexual abuse claims, began distributing payments last fall to victims. But unless Iowa legislators take action by the deadline, the estimated roughly 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they otherwise would be entitled to. When figuring compensation, the settlement uses a matrix that weighs a variety of factors, including a state's civil statutes of limitations. The Iowa statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult that their injuries and sufferings are related to their alleged abuse. Because of Iowa's short statute of limitations, victims in the state could see their financial compensation from the scouts reduced by 60% to 70% compared with victims in other states, according to an attorney. And even then, people might only be paid 5% to 10% of the value because there's not enough money in the fund. The Senate bill, modeled after legislation passed in Alabama, creates an exception to Iowa's civil statute of limitations for injuries resulting from childhood sexual abuse for purposes of making a claim in a bankruptcy proceeding that was initiated on February 18, 2020, against the bankruptcy estate of a congressionally chartered organization. The language effectively would limit the exception to the Boy Scouts. The act would be repealed December 31, 2026. Senator Janet Peterson, District Des Moines, who has long advocated for eliminating the limitations and creating a revival window for survivors to file claims, thanked survivors for coming forward to share painful stories with lawmakers to prevent a system that failed to protect them as children from hurting them again as grown-ups. Corinne Brink said, "Lawmakers were working to ensure that measure makes it to Reynolds' desk in time." The governor told reporters that she is open to supporting the bill. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 11th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Anna from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. All right. And our next story is Reynolds rejects proposed tweaks to AEA law. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds rebuffed calls for changes to the law overhauling the state's special education providers, as some House lawmakers want to change what they saw as an oversight in the bill they passed. Reynolds signed the bill into law in March that changed the funding structures and oversight of the state's area education agencies, which provide special education support, media services, and other education services to school districts. Making changes to the AEAs was Reynolds' top legislative priority this year. Though the final law differed significantly from her original proposal. Once fully implemented, the law will require school districts to spend 90% of their special education funding with an AEA, while they will have a district discretion from over 10%. But for the other AEA functions, media services and educational services, by the second year under the new law, school districts will receive the full amount currently going into AEAs, about $68 million. Districts will have broad flexibility over the spending. They can contact with the AEAs for those services, seek them from another vendor, or put their money into general funds to spend at other areas. Now, some House representatives are saying that there was an oversight in the final proposal and are looking to change the law to require the money be spent on the intended services, the Des Moines Register first reported. Reynolds says that she does not support any change to the legislation while speaking with reporters on Tuesday. She said schools should be allowed to spend media and education service dollars however they see fit. "I'm absolutely not," Reynolds said when asked if she was open to changes. "That was the deal. First of all, it's about local control. They know best what's important for the kids in their district, and so they're going to decide how to use that money and how it should always be." House Representative Brent Seardrist, Council Bluffs, who previously led the Iowa Association of Area Education Agencies, said he and some other lawmakers want spending from those sources to be restricted only to the services they're currently intended for, while still allowing school districts to seek those services outside the AEA. That change could be made by inserting the language into budget bills. It's unclear whether House leadership will make that move, and Seardrist said that he is not sure that the Senate would pass it. "Hopefully the Senate will do what we think when they should, and we'll take it from there," he said. Bill passes to regulate nuisance strip clubs. The Iowa Senate passed a bill that would allow cities to limit the hours of strip clubs they see determined to be a danger to public safety. Larger cities in Iowa, led by Davenport, have pushed for the bill in wake of the recent shootings. The bill, House File 2531, would allow a county or attorney or city attorney to sue a strip club and request a court order to limit the hours from noon to 10 p.m. If they determine that the club is a public safety nuisance, that is. The court could also prohibit alcohol on the premises. An establishment could be considered a public safety nuisance if someone or near establishment fires a gun, assaults another person with dangerous weapons, or engages in a riot on three or more times a year. The court could impose additional sanctions on the establishment after trial if they determine a public safety nuisance exists. I apologize. Similar action covering bars was signed into law in 2022, but officials say that law does not cover establishments that don't serve alcohol. The bill was amended to replace adult cabaret with an existing definition of adult establishments in code that provide nude or topless dancing. It also replaces reference to gunfire, assaults, and riots occurring within 500 feet of the premises with language used for public nuisance bars, which includes the parking lot and spaces adjacent to the establishment. The bill now heads back to the Iowa House for final passage. And moving on again, sheriff's retirement changes advance in Senate. Senate lawmakers advanced a House bill Tuesday that would make changes to the Iowa public employees' retirement system for sheriffs and deputies, including increasing the applicable percentage for the retirement benefit payments. It would also provide that a person charged with the murder or felony assault of a law enforcement or corrections officer is not eligible for bail. And it would create a tax credit of up to $2,000 for public safety officers moving to the state of Iowa. House File 2661 increases the maximum IPRS retirement benefit from 72% to 80%, and it establishes an annual 1.5 cost of living adjustment to the monthly allowance for sheriff and deputy service members of IPRS for retirements occurring or after July 1st. Representatives for the Iowa State Association of Counties and Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association spoke in favor of the legislation, saying it will help recruitment and retention efforts statewide. We have seen an increase of loss in deputies to the large city police departments and the state patrol, said Tony Phillips, representing the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. We can address pay. That can make the office a friendlier environment for the deputies to work in. The one thing we cannot address in the sheriff's office is the pension system. Phillips said bill provides a modest pension increase that's split evenly between the county and retirees. For every dollar increase in this pension system is shared 50-50 between the county and the deputies, he said. Kelly Paschke, representing the Iowa Peace Officers Association, raised concerns the bill excludes local law enforcement who are not part of the pension system out of the benefit increase. Paschke encouraged lawmakers to include other law enforcement groups like county conservation officers, university and small-town police officers in future pension legislation. The bill unanimously passed Iowa House last month with a vote of 93-0. It now moves to full Senate Ways and Means Committee for consideration. And the next story, Senate advances film tax rebate resurrection. Iowa lawmakers are one step closer to reviving a long-defunct program giving tax incentives to studios that produce film in Iowa after legislation passed its first hurdle in the Senate on Monday. A Senate subcommittee advanced House File 2662, which the House passed last month, moving it onto the full Appropriations Committee. Film studios would be able to claim up to a 30% tax rebate for the qualified expenses under the bill. The bill would not create a $10 million pilot program for the first year and require more legislative action to make it permanent. A similar program existed from 2007 to 2009, but it was ended after it was found that millions of dollars in tax rebates were improperly issued. Lawmakers said that they were confident that the program will have better oversight this time. Our next short story is Religious Charity Funding Bill Signed into Law. Counties and townships may devote money to religious organizations for public services under a bill signed by law by Governor Kim Reynolds. The new law allows church-managed organizations to receive public money if it is for a project, according to the text, that benefits the public and does not require any religious or secular services, educational programs, or participation requirements, end quote. The law supporters have said such services could include food pantries, homeless shelters, and child care. The bill, House File 2264, received widespread support in the Iowa legislature, passing the Iowa House 94-2 and the Senate 38-10. All right, and the next short story I will be reading is Bill, Grooming by Teachers Must Be Reported. A bill that would require school districts to report state officials if a licensed employee is disciplined for grooming or abusing a student is headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. Current law requires that districts must report to the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners, the state's educating license body, if a teacher or other license holder is disciplined for conduct that constitutes, quote, soliciting, encouraging, or consummating, end quote, a sexual or inappropriate relationship with a student. House File 2487 would add to grooming behavior and abusing a student to the list of actions that must be reported to the board if an employee is disciplined. Grooming behavior is defined in the bill as any behavior which, in light of all relevant circumstances, is meant to entice or entrap a student or students with the intent to engage in a sex act. It defines inappropriate relationship as a sexual relationship or one in which sexual harassment or physical or sexual abuse occurs or is otherwise not in compliance with generally accepted educational practices. The House concurred with a state Senate amending removed and replacing reference to romantic relationship with sexual relationship. If the Board of Education Examiners has evidence that a school staff member committed a crime, the board would need to report it to authorities. It also removes a 3-year limitation on investigating a complaint if it falls under the grooming behavior definition. The amended bill passed the House unanimously on Monday. It now heads to Governor Reynolds for her signature. We all want to hold bad actors accountable in our schools and make a positive, safe environment for them. And I believe that this bill will do that, said Representative Brooke Brodin of Indianola, the bill's floor manager. And now we will be reading obituaries. First, we have Lisa R. Schaefer, born October 18th, 1967, and passed away April 1st, 2020. Lisa Schaefer, age 56, of Stillwell, KS, entered into heaven on April 1st, 2024, surrounded by her family. On October 18th, 1967, a beautiful baby girl, Lisa Renee Clausen, was born to Hilton and Mary Clausen in Seneca, Kansas. Lisa grew up in Council Bluffs with her mom raising her 3 children in the Catholic faith. Lisa graduated from St. Albert's High School in 1986. From there, she attended Morningside College and Iowa State University, where she met John and many close friends. John and Lisa were married on September 24th, 1994, and together they built a beautiful life and beloved family with the blessing of 3 children. Throughout her life, she exemplified dedication, kindness, and grace with always a smile and a joyful laugh. Lisa was the heart and soul of her family. Her unwavering love and support served as a guiding light to all who knew her. Her devotion to her husband, children, and extended family was unparalleled, and her presence brought warmth and comfort to those around her. She was a woman of great faith and trust in the Lord, even in the most difficult times. A woman of many talents, Lisa found joy in cooking and crafting, infusing love and creativity into every dish and scrapbook. Lisa's heart was genuine, and she welcomed friends and family with open arms. Nothing was more important to Lisa than friends and family. Most photos of her will be celebrating with them and talking or laughing during the picture. Lisa spent most of her work life in customer service, where her caring heart served her and her customers very well. Lisa's legacy of love, compassion, and generosity will live on in the hearts of all who are fortunate enough to know her. Though she may no longer be with us in body, Her spirit will continue to inspire and uplift us each day. Lisa is survived by her loving husband, John, and three devoted children, Drew, Faith, Lauren, and Ella. Mother, Mary, and her caring brothers and their families, Kevin Deva, Clausen, Kurt Clausen, and her nieces, Kaylee and Clarice, nephews. Kenneth, Nick, Corey, Jonan, Dylan, and Benjamin Lisa were preceded in death by her father, Hilton Clausen of Nebraska, August 15, 2023. She is mourned by many aunts, uncles, and cousins, and an extended family. A rosary will be prayed at 4 p.m., followed by a visitation until 6 p.m., Thursday, April 11, 2024, at Porter Funeral Home. Monrovia Street, Lenexa, Kansas, and funeral mass will be at 10 a.m. Friday, April 12th, at the Church of the Ascension Catholic Church, 9510 West 127th Street, Overland Park, Kansas, 66213. Memorial donations may be made to Kansas City Young Audiences or the Rebel Softball Scholarship in honor of Lisa Shaver. Okay, and then Ethan H. Rasmussen, born August 18, 1928, and passed away April 7, 2024. Ethan Hall Rasmussen of Council Bluffs passed away April 7, 2024 in his home. He was born August 18, 1928, at the home of his parents, Marion and Mary Rasmussen, at R.R. Neola, Iowa. He graduated from Beebe Town in High School in Logan, Iowa, in 1946. In 1948, he and Maxine Lois Fisher of Neola were married. For 9 years, they operated Grade A dairy farms near Crescent, Iowa, and Logan. During this period, Mr. Rasmussen served for 5 years in the Iowa National Guard. Discontinuing their dairy operation in 1957, the Rasmussens moved to Council Bluffs, and Ethan began employment with a milk marketing and processing cooperative with general offices in Omaha. During the following 36 years, he held supervisory and managerial positions in the cooperative, retiring as vice president and the general manager of Western Operation of Mid-American Dairymen, Incorporated. Throughout his career, Ethan also served as a board member for several state and regional dairy-related organizations. These included the American Dairy Association and Dairy Council of Nebraska from 1974 until 1993. He was further retained as a consultant for the board of directors for these organizations until December 31, 2009. Ethan was a member of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Council Bluffs, where he served as an usher for over 50 years. Ethan was preceded in death by his parents and brothers, Bennett, Quentin, Jr., and Roland, and his wife of 72 years, Maxine. He is survived by his sons, Douglas and Sydney, and his sister, Rosanna M. Russell, and nieces, nephews, and other relatives, and many friends. Visitation with the family, Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill, Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service, Saturday, 10:45 a.m. at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, 600 Bluff Street Internment, Ridge Road Cemetery, with a lunch following at the church. Memorials are suggested to Our Savior's Lutheran Church. And we have Dorothy Kelso. She was born March 2nd, 1929, and passed away April 5th, 2024. Dorothy Kelso, age 95, born at home on March 2nd, 1929, in Little Sioux, Iowa, to Richard and Daisy Haney, and passed away April 5th, 2024. She married the love of her life, Arnold Kelso, in 1946. They had three daughters, Phyllis, Robin, and Valerie, and two sons, Ronald and Stephen. Dorothy gave her life to the Lord in 1963 and served him devotedly for the rest of her life. She was preceded in death by her husband, mother, father, and four sisters, Lois, Ethel, Vera, and Laferne, and her brother, Lester, and her grandson, Bart. She is survived by her three daughters and two sons, many grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. at Hoy Kalinowski Funeral Home on Friday, April 12, 2024. Visitation held an hour prior to the service. The family will direct memorials. And then in memoriam, we have Scott Richardson, born April 27th, 1974, and died on this day, April 11th, 2020. Not a day goes by that we don't think of you and smile or cry, or both. You are loved and missed by your words. Your family. Cemetery lots. 2 one-length cemetery lots, $600 each. Now we will be moving on to sports. And we're going to start with high school boys soccer. Red flag, Cardinals take the Wild. Trainer won a Wild Western Iowa conference game over Underwood 7-2 at Cardinal Stadium on Tuesday night. With just under 4 minutes to play in the contest, Trainer head coach Jason McIntosh and Underwood head coach Eric Rogers met briefly and mutually agreed to stop playing, but not before over a dozen cards were issued among the teams, including 3 red cards to the Eagles. With the game mostly in hand and decided, the two coaches had decided enough was enough. Quote, "We came here pretty amped up and take a lot of pride in the fact that we haven't lost a conference game over the past 4 years," end quote, McIntosh said. "It was unfortunate. You really hate to see a game turn out like that. And with 3 guys get sat down like that over red cards." It took 12 minutes before the game's first goal broke the early silence, but Danny Kinsella booted in the first of the night. 6 minutes later, Brock Poland made it 2-0 in the favor of the Cardinals. It would be another 10 minutes before Tyson McCain headed in a 28th-minute goal. Peter Young headed in a goal of his own in the 33-minute, followed by Kinsella's second goal of the day, with a 36th-minute as Trainer went into halftime ahead 5-0. "This was our first big test of the season, and for the most part, I think we responded well," Kinsella said. "Our offense was clicking well. We were talking and moving the ball, and when we do that, good things really happen. And we are glad to see those results in a high-emotion game." Okay, and another high school boys soccer story, roller coaster. Cruz gives Lynx first win of season. Thomas Jefferson's Royer wins 250th. And there is a picture of 3 players and they're hugging. "It was a roller coaster for sure," said Abraham Lincoln head coach Jameson Parkhill after Tuesday's 3-2 win over Sioux City East. "We go up 2-0, they come back, score within 30 seconds, and then tie it 2-2, and then we get that final one of a kind to deal it. Well, it feels good, honestly," matchmaker Irvin Cruz added. "Getting that win, we obviously needed it, and the goals we get, I feel like after today, our team is going to be more confident going into games and putting those chances away." Jonathan Amador passed 2 goals and the match-winning assist on Cruz's goal as the Lynx notched their first win of the season in Missouri River Conference in match Tuesday night. "Me and Irvin are having a good connection with each other," Amador said. "I think me and him know each other on the field, and I think our through balls work mostly every time. I saw Irving make the run, and defender was turning, had his back turned." Cruz hit a shot with the outside of his right boot and found the bottom right corner of the net to reestablish the Lynx lead at 3-2 with 15 minutes to play. "We remain calm, and we kind of have that connection together playing club," Cruz said. "And I kind of just saw him out of the corner of my eye, just pass and see whatever happened. And on that goal, I was just trying to stay as calm as I can, you know, bury it in the net for the winning goal." The win gives the Lynx confidence after coming up short while struggling on set pieces and missed opportunities and losses to Bishop Helan, Lewis Central, and against what Parkhill called a tournament caliber in Ames. And then we have high school track and field, final push. Saints win Griswold girls relays. Underwood boys win Ken Karsten's invite. St. Albert won the Griswold girls relays and their Underwood boys won at Harlan Ken Karsten's invitational on Tuesday. Saints reign supreme. The Saints totaled 149 points, outscoring Woodbine and Riverside in the AA division at Griswold St. Albert's Winners, where Kiera Hochstein with 100 hurdles, Lily Denton, Ava Underwood, and the 800 sprint medley and distance medley. The Saints were also second in the shuttle hurdles with 4 by 400 with Monahan, St. Denton, Lenz, and Denton. Walter was third in the 100, Monahan third in the 200, South Denton third in the 400, Hochstein and Klusman second and third in the 400 hurdles, Ryan and Kristen Piskorski third and fourth in 1500, and Molly, I don't know how to pronounce the last name, Rosloniec, third in the shot put. Third place Riverside was led by wins from Lydia Erickson, Carly Henderson, Madison Kelly, 4x4, and 4x800. The Bulldogs were also second in the 4x10 and 4x200. I'm sorry, 4x100 and 4x200, and third in the shuttle hurdles and distance medley. Sophia Taylor and Kaden Schnack were both second. AHSTW placed fourth, winning the 4x200 and earning six top three finishes. In the A division, Harlan Christian placed fourth, Kira Diem and Grace Steinmetz winning their events. Iowa School for the Deaf Refinance, again, I don't know how to say the last word, KISICHY was fourth in the long jump. Okay, and to finish off today's reading, I'm going to end with gardening, just for the spring. Pre-annual produce. Not all vegetables are annuals. Here are some that come back year after year. Most vegetables grown in home gardens are annuals. They wither and die at the end of the season and need to be replanted every year to reap more crops. But if you're short on time or money, don't want to be bothered with yearly planting, or want to try something new, I've got just the plants for you. Pre-annual vegetables. Preparing the soil. If you were ever to prioritize improving your soil, it should be before planting pre-annuals. Since the bed will contain plants for years to come, it's the only chance you'll get to truly mix in compost or manure. Till and amendments to adjust to the soil's pH and properly dig weeds up by their roots without the risk of distributing nearby plants. It's also an excellent time to incorporate in an organic fertilizer. Just as a house needs a good foundation, healthy plants begin with healthy soil. Seize the opportunity while you have it. One benefit of growing pre-annual crops is that they're generally low maintenance. Once you've planted a crop, there will be no need to plant it again, so you won't find yourself tilling, turning, or digging the soil again as long as they are in your garden. Going forward, sprinkle an inch or two of compost, and in most cases, a dose of fertilizer granules over the soil every spring. Just as when growing ornamental perennials, be sure to confirm that your growing conditions match your chosen plants, individuals' requirements, such as cold hardness, pH range, sunlight exposure, and water needs. Giving them time. Some perennial vegetables should already be allowed to fully establish in the garden before harvesting. Asparagus, for instance, is an exercise in patience. Plants should be followed to grow undisturbed for 2 years full before harvesting. Plant them in spring, and when third-year stalks are 6 to 10 inches tall, use a sharp knife to cut each slightly below the soil line. Start harvesting in early July to allow plants to store up the energy required for the next year's crop. Rhubarb also shouldn't be harvested immediately. You can, however, sample up to 4 stalks per plant in the second year. Plant bare root crowns with their buds or eyes facing upward, 2 inches below the soil surface in either spring or fall, allowing 3 to 4 between plants. Starting in their first year, harvest stalks when they are between 12 and 18 inches long, but never remove more than 2/3 of each plant. Quicker gratification. Jerusalem artichokes, also called sunchokes, are quick-spreading plants that can take over a garden bed, so consider growing them in their own place. Plant 3 to 5 inches deep and 12 to 18 inches apart in early spring. The easy-to-grow plants aren't particular about soil type and don't need annual fertilization, but they cannot tolerate soggy soils. Harvest tubers in autumn, preferably after a couple of light frosts, will improve their flavor, but allow some time to remain in the ground to produce the next year's crop. Egyptian walking onions are unusual, fun to grow onions that spread as they walk across the garden bed. Not considered invasive because they can be easily controlled, unwanted plants pull up easily. These onions grow clusters of small bulbils. When they have become too heavy for the plant to bear, the stalks bend over, resting the bulbils on the soil surface. Before long, the bulbils root and grow into new plants. Harvest bulbils anytime and use them as you would onions, or dig up full-size onions in late summer, allowing some time to remain in the ground in the next year. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, April 11th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Anna from Drake University in Des Moines, and thank you for sharing your time with the IRIS Iowa Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you.